12, 2011, present Representative Lynn, Representative Keller, Representative Gruenberg, and Representative Holmes, Vice Chair Representative Thompson, myself, Chair Gatto, Representative Pruitt will not be able to attend today. We have five court cases: Anderson versus Alyeska Pipeline, Matsu Valley Medical Center versus Advanced Pain Centers, Planned Parenthood versus Campbell, Weimer versus Continental Care and Truck, and West versus State. I'm going to ask first housekeeping. If you have a phone, put it on vibrate. Makes for a better meeting. Then I'm going to take the first 5 minutes to talk a little bit about an Anchorage ordinance that dealt with a cab driver who allegedly raped a woman. She then got away and was picked up by another person. The cab driver walked toward that car, but the other person happened to have just come from a shooting range and he had a pistol in the back seat. He used the pistol and subdued the cab driver. And the question came about, it's only alleged that he raped the woman, but the ordinance intends to pull his license based on an allegation. And so because I have two attorneys here who might be more familiar with that, I'm going to ask for opinion about the legality of pulling a person's license based on an allegation. Not that I think the cab driver's innocent, that's not the matter here. There is some information that probably not, but that's just information and allegations. So I wanted to take the first 5 minutes or slightly more to get an opinion from the members on the committee as to whether or not we think an ordinance pulling a person's license based on an allegation would be constitutional. Representative Holmes, as an attorney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And we're going to have a lot of attorneys, I assume, on the phone today or here, and we might want them to weigh in. But my first, I'm not familiar with this, and I haven't thought about it up until the last 5 minutes, but I would think that the license would be a substantial enough property right that it might warrant, at the very least, an emergency hearing. I think the public safety issues of pulling a license for somebody who's been accused of a violent rape, it's clearly some serious public safety issues involved, and I think very well might be warranted, but there might be some sort of constitutional requirement to have at least an emergency hearing on it.
So in the order of things, pull the license, have an emergency hearing, or don't pull the license and then have an emergency hearing. I'm just curious. I said I would bring this up. Representative Gruenberg?
I tend to agree.
Agree. Okay.
There's some cases on it. A case called Baker versus the City of Fairbanks that says if you're faced with jail time, a substantial fine, or the loss of a valuable license, you have a right to a jury trial. If it's a court case rather than an administrative hearing, which means that the Supreme Court feels that the loss of a valuable license and a cab driver's license would be a valuable license. You have due process protection.
Well, it's the only way that he has to earn a living. I mean, that cab license, short of finding a different job, the license, running a cab requires that you have a permit.
And of course, you've got that competing against public safety.
Absolutely.
And so, primarily we want to protect the public. We also want to protect people's property rights, so that's why I would think maybe a hearing would be in order.
As somebody back home told me, he said, my daughter takes cabs all the time. I don't want her getting in his cab. Okay. I don't either. I fully understand. Fully understand. Okay. We have legal services online. Is there someone from legal services?
Sure.
Representative Gruenberg?
Just as a request. Personal request here. If we have time at the end,
mm-hmm.
I would like to bring up two other cases,
right.
One of which is the Hertz case that's found on page 7 here of the book. And the second is a case dealing with the escape statute that has received some considerable publicity, as well as it's been the subject of an editorial in the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. Annie Carpinetti's going to give a status report on that case as well.
Sounds fine to me. Annie Carpinetti, are you online?
Yes, I am.
Good morning and welcome to Judiciary via the telephone.
Thank you.
The comments we made about the cab driver, did you have something that you could add to that?
No, thank you. I don't. Tough issue. I wouldn't disagree with what the two previous speakers said.
Okay, and I tend to agree myself. Okay. Any more comments about that one issue? Seeing and hearing none, why don't we move then to the cases that we wanted to review. Anderson versus Alyeska Pipeline Service Company. I think this boils down to a question of if a company has work comp insurance and they do something that causes you to be injured, it's pretty clear they will pay for your injuries and your time off. The question in this case, I believe, is can you then turn around after having received work comp and paid time off to go ahead and sue them because they had an unsafe situation? So and I think I got that right. I think it was a table behind a cart that wasn't secured, and the cart moved. That caused the table to fall over. She was bent down vacuuming. The table weighed 70 pounds and fell on her. It's pretty clear that this was something that. Okay, Jerry, are you on online?
Mr. Chairman, this is Jerry Luckup. I am online, and I also have with me Jean Michelle. And okay. Dennis Bailey. I can answer any questions generally about how we provide, do the report, the summary of cases, and I think Dennis is going to discuss the Alyeska case for you now.
That's what we'd like to do right now, if that's possible. So, Dennis, you have to put yourself on the record and give us a summary.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dennis Bailey, and I'm an attorney at Fletcher Legal.
No Dennis? We're not receiving any audio from you if you're giving it. I don't know if you're on mute, but we're not receiving you.
Is that any better? I'm drawing my mic up close. Is that any better?
Yeah, we can hear you now. Even closer would help.
Okay. We'll try this. Right, right up at mouth level.
Good. Thank you. And we'll get somebody here to turn up the receiving volume. So go ahead, put yourself on the record, and then give us your comments.
I guess I would preface the remarks by the purpose and the recommendations that we've made in the report for legislative review. And that is that we try and identify problem areas or conflicts or areas where the law is applied in an unusual way, or if there's particular issues that the legislature might want to be aware of. The issue, there are a number of issues in this case that include issues of exclusive liability under the workers' comp statute. However, the issue that we wanted to draw the legislator's attention to is the question of the liability up the chain of contractors that provides that if a subcontractor doesn't provide workers' comp coverage, then the contractor's liable. And if the contractor doesn't provide coverage, the project owner is liable. And the Anderson case reviewed the issue of what a project owner means. It reviewed the definition in the statute. And it identified a question concerning what a project owner is and how it would apply in this case. Now, the reason that we've identified this case for extra consideration is in the decision, the court has identified possible unintended consequences or possible interpretations that may or may not have been intended in the statute. And those issues really, I don't know if you can boil them down, but the issue might arise when the project owner contracts with a contractor in a situation that's not necessarily a construction contract. And the circumstance may arise, and the ones that were identified in the case, when, say, for example, a law firm hires a company and they contract with the company to do their delivery service. It's certainly arguable in this case that the liability of the project owner would fall on the owners of the law firm, and that if there was a liability presented, they may be liable for the workers' comp coverage of the people who are their contractor rather than their employees. The court identified that issue, and they also identified the issue of a building owner hiring a plow company as a contractor. And under the language that makes the project owner liable for the workers' comp coverage of a subcontractor, presuming that, or the contractor, if the contractor doesn't provide the coverage, there's a potential liability that the building owner might be liable for the workers' comp coverage of the snowplow company. So that's the issue that the court identified, and that's the reason that the decision is in front of you. The there's a couple other points that I wanted to make, and that is the court identified this issue itself in, based on the arguments of the party, and they specifically limited their case to the specific facts of the case, recognizing that there is a certain amount of validity, or there's some validity to the arguments that were made by the opposing parties. So whether they would decide that in another case remains to be seen, but that's the issue that was identified in our publication to bring to the attention of the legislature.
Can it be boiled down to, let's say a renter decides that there's a lot of snow and he has permission from the homeowner to go ahead and call a snow plowing company. So he calls a snow plowing company and they have subcontractors. The subcontractor's plowing snow, runs the plow right into the well pipe. The well pipe doesn't move even an eighth of an inch. And he, meanwhile, gets thrown against the steering wheel, the airbag deploys, and he's injured. He goes up the line and says, well, I'm a subcontractor. The contractor should have made work comp available. But he didn't. So now you go up the line to the renter, and you go up the line to finally the homeowner. The homeowner didn't want anything to do with this. Why they hired somebody to plow the snow. Is the homeowner ultimately, as the top of the chain of command, the person liable for having work comp, and if they don't, then they can be sued?
Well, let me see if I can simplify the question one step further, and that is that the project owner, which is a debatable issue that was discussed in the case, could be considered the building owner, if you consider that a project, or potentially it could be considered the snowplow driver, I suppose, the snowplow company as a contractor, might be considered a, well, I guess I'm not a project owner. So the those are questions of extraneous liability and exclusive liability under the statute. Those issues have been debated. And the legislature decided that the exclusive liability provisions of the workers' comp statute would apply to the project owner. That issue was addressed in this case, but it didn't present a controversial issue that we normally identify in our process of identifying cases for the legislature. essentially they applied the law. They said the law is that the project owner enjoys the exclusive liability of that a contractor would enjoy as a employer. So I guess the summary or the point of that is that the legislature made a decision that that exclusive liability would apply to project owners. That's really not the issue, and that was applied in this case in a routine manner. That's not the reason that we've identified this case for the legislature's consideration.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I found this to be actually by far the most interesting of the five cases, because there are kind of two things that are brought up, the first of which I don't think is really in front of us. The first one is just the question of whether they decided this case correctly, whether we like the idea that project owners are responsible for workers' comp and therefore have immunity and can't be sued for negligence, and that their liability basically is capped. I mean, I'm a contractor. I hire subcontractors. One of their people gets hurt. If the subcontractor doesn't have workers' comp insurance, my workers' comp covers, but then I also, as the owner, have protection in that I can't be sued for negligence. That was a decision made by the legislature a few years ago. You can like it or hate it, but that's the current statute. And it sounds like it was correctly applied in this case. So that's a policy debate that's obviously still ongoing in the legislature as to whether that was decided correctly at the statutory level, but that's the lay of the land in front of us. The fascinating issue here that I think Dennis has correctly identified and the court correctly identified is what is a project owner and how far does this go? I mean, if I'm on a construction site, it's pretty clear that things go down the line, and if your subcontractor doesn't have workers' comp or their subcontractor doesn't have workers' comp, that's going to go all the way up to the chain. That's kind of clear under the law. What's not clear is once you get out of a construction concept, how far does this go? And this kind of probed the edges of it because the Alyeska pipeline may or may not have been sort of a project or a construction site, but how far does this go? Does this go... like they said, the law firm that hires a bookkeeper, and the bookkeeper or something happens, or you contract both individuals and companies, hire people to clean their buildings, they hire people to do this, they hire people to do that all the time in the routine business. And the question is, what does the legislature want to do in those cases? Do they want everybody who hires anybody to have that liability go all the way up the chain, which is one legitimate policy decision, or do we not? How do we want to protect workers and make sure that when they get injured, somebody takes care of them? Also, how do we want to deal with people being sued for negligence? When do we want things covered by workers' comp? When do we want people to be able to sue? Who should they be able to sue? What should employers of subcontractors be looking out for? I think the court's identified a real gray area that we might want to probe a little and get a little clarity.
Well, I had this question.
A long little monologue. Sorry about that.
I'll be right back to you. Is the ultimate project owner the state of Alaska? If it's going up, well, Alyeska Pipeline Company is, operating off state lands and taking state resources, and anyway, the question came to me, as long as we're going to go up the line and find the project owner, maybe we didn't go far enough. Mm. Representative.
Just to throw another curve into what you talked about, Chairman Gatto, is so you've got the snowplow company that hired the subcontractor under him, but then you've got the renter, and then you've got maybe a rental management company, because the owner of the building is an absentee owner that lives outside. He rents a rental management company, so they're involved. And then you get up to the building owner. How far does this go? I mean, you really get spread out.
I think that's right. Representative Fruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This case, I'm glad we're taking it up first for a different reason. As I looked at these cases, it seemed to me that a number of them were not within my area of expertise, because some of them deal with resource issues, Some of them deal with health and social service issues. This one happens to deal with labor and commerce, and at least one member of our committee is on that committee, and I know other members have served on that committee. And what I would like to make a suggestion on some of these, if the committee members agree, present either important or difficult or interesting policy issues that are not within our primary responsibility, that we take a motion to refer the case and the notes from the LAA to the Committee of First Referral, because with the thought that if they do introduce a bill on the subject, that we would make sure through the chair that this committee would then be a subsequent committee of referral. So we get the primary committee of jurisdictions input on that first. And I would ask the committee members and the chair if they would be agreeable to such a procedure today.
And I thought about that, and I said, do we even need a motion? Couldn't I just refer to them? But
well, I think if it's a motion...
Let me finish. If we do with a motion, then we're all in agreement.
That's right. And that's why I would suggest that, since we have a history in this committee this last year of working together in a bipartisan fashion, and I think we've done a pretty good job of it, that's just my opinion, that we try to see if we have consensus like that. And I would be prepared to make such a motion.
I have one other question I'm not sure of on the legal side of things. Back to my workers' compensation board days. If the subcontractor had workers' compensation and the employee was paid, medical bills were paid, lost wages were paid, and then that employee went back and tried to sue the project owner, LASCA. It used to be, and I don't know if it still is, that if they were to succeed in that lawsuit, the first person that got paid was the workers' comp insurance company, because you had to redo that. Is that still the way that is? Or?
I think so.
I'm a divorce lawyer.
This is Dennis Bailey speaking. I think the answer to your question is yes. I don't claim to be the total expert on workers' comp, but my understanding is that workers' comp provides for a lien, and if the injured party recovers damages through a third party for the same damages, that the workers' comp carrier can assert a subrogation lien against the proceeds.
Thank you, Dennis.
So why don't we just go ahead and entertain a motion, Representative Gruenberg?
I'm going to make a slightly. I'm going to make the motion. I'm going to make the motion, but it's with a caveat. I move that the issue on workers' comp and the case for that purpose be referred to Labor and Commerce and ask unanimous consent. But then I'd like to talk about the other issue in the case. That is a very important issue that's squarely within our jurisdiction. So my motion is to refer the workers' comp issue to Labor and Commerce.
Is there an objection? Seeing and hearing none, motion carries.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bailey, with your permission, I would like to turn our attention for the next few minutes to the second issue in the case, which deals with an offer of judgment. And that is found in the case on page 8. B, it was error to award LASCA Rule 68 attorney's fees. Yeah. And what they said, there's what's called... Civil Rule 68, and there's also some statutes involved, which are not at issue here. An offer of judgment is a document that either party can serve on the other party and offer to have judgment taken to a certain extent or for a certain amount. And if that is accepted, then the document is lodged. It's an offer, and you accept it, and then you enter a judgment by stipulation, essentially. If it's
basically a settlement.
Yeah, approved by the court, it becomes a judgment. If it's rejected and you do better at trial than your offer, then you can get your actual attorney's fees. And it is a real hammer. And there's another set of statutes that also adjust the interest rate in the same way. But you have to cite it, and it's in a formal way of doing it. The offer of judgment in this case was offered by the defense for, I think it was $10.
$10, right.
Nominal sum. And they said this, in accord with another case, was not an appropriate subject because it was such a trivial amount. On the other hand, though, it was a real deterrent because rather than getting a sum of money, the other party and the lawyer would have had to have a discussion that you may be liable not just for Rule 82 attorney's fees, which is partial, but for their total attorney's fees. And that's a considerable difference. It is a real deterrent. Something that isn't discussed in the opinion is that a nominal offer of judgment only works one way. Only the defendant can use a nominal offer of judgment. And, for $10. Because a plaintiff would have to have a sum of money. And they could say that, we're asking for $1 million, but we'll settle for $100,000. But if a case is only worth $100,000, you can't really do that to any extent. The use of a defense offer of judgment like this is useful when the real issue is liability. Because either there you're liable or you're not. But on the other hand, if this decision were reversed by the legislature or by a future court, the change would benefit defendants at the cost of plaintiffs. So there are some issues here. Secondly, the whole subject of offers of judgment usually only apply in money cases. But in the field of family law, they can be helpful if you're working out a custody matter or something like that. And courts vary in whether they allow offers of judgment. Most of them don't. So my question to the committee, and a suggestion, because this, I don't have an answer to this. This is just a case that brings up a Rule 68 offer of judgment. The statutes would be inapplicable because they're talking about interest. This is talking about attorney's fees. And you have attorney's fees, and the rules on attorney's fees are different in family law cases, et cetera. The question is whether the committee would like to think about this further. I can give it some thought and come back with a report to a future meeting of the committee.
And we wanted to move on to case number two here anyway. So we've already voted to give labor and commerce.
On the one issue.
On the one issue, but the attorney fee issue is still...
But what I'd like to know is if the committee would have any objection if I think about this and maybe get some better advice from other people on whether we should... This is not something that's come up to me today. It's something I thought long and hard about it over years in my practice.
I don't think we're going to object to you spending some thought. I don't think we can stop you. All right. Let's go on to number two, which is closer to certificate of need. When we built a new hospital in Matsu, right there at the junction of the two highways, they had to get a certificate of need. And certificate of need is really based on the idea that says, we don't want two hospitals side by side and have them both fail. So we'll get a certificate of need, decide what your needs are, and we'll build one hospital. And then if a second hospital wants to show up, they'll have to show this in another certificate of need. And that's what this case is dwelling on, because what I saw happen was a Palmer Hospital became a private hospital and then Providence showed up, and the argument back and forth was they're just going to skim off the top or something like that. So that's why I believe this case. I think it's the Pain Center sought to convert office space into a single suite ambulatory surgery center. And boy, that sounds like a big jump from an office suite where you have a doctor's office and now you're doing, you have a surgery center. So do we have someone online that is most familiar with the certificate of need and this specific issue?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is Jean Michelle with Legal Services.
Oh, hi. You're on the record. Go ahead and give us your comments.
Hi. Good morning. First of all, the issue in this Map 2 Valley case was not a question of whether the pain center that developed the suite violated a certificate of need. They didn't have a certificate of need at all. And the challenger to the lack of, or the, actually the commissioner's determination that a certificate of need was not required, waited beyond the administrative review period to file a complaint. So there was a threshold standing question that became really the primary concern for the court in this. And in reviewing whether or not the medical center, the Massey Valley Medical Center, had standing to challenge the failure of the Commissioner of Health and Social Services to issue a certificate of need, the court ruled that the statute 1807031 and 1807091. What the commissioner had decided below was that the dollar amount didn't meet the certificate of need threshold. And the pain center challenged that determination and said that the medical center challenged the determination and said that the pain center had underestimated the value of their conversion. But we had an ambiguity in the statute that set out the three categories of persons who could challenge that decision, not a violation, but the decision not to require a certificate of need for that kind of conversion. And the court went through some painstaking analysis about why the third category of people who could challenge the lack of issuance of the certificate of need included Matthew Valley Medical Center. The decision finally turned on a grammatical construction of the statute, and so we have, as a legislature, we have some concern that that statute was inartfully drafted or confusing. The court corrected any ambiguity in favor of opening up challenges to the failure to issue a certificate of need in this case. And the question for the legislature, or legislative council at least, is whether that was the correct interpretation given the confusing nature of the wording of the statute. And I'm happy to explain a little bit further about why that became an issue, but the primary concern was that there was an ambiguity that the court resolved broadly.
Can you give us the wording that at least was either misleading or difficult to interpret?
Yes, I can. It's 1807. 090, and the problem that the court identified was the use of the word violation in the last phrase of that statute. And I'm just I'm looking for the exact language of the statute.
Chairman, I think it's 091, isn't it? That's the only one we have.
Are you referring to 091 or 090?
091.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so the statute provides that injunctive relief against violations of this chapter or regulations under this chapter may be obtained from a court at the instance of, and the third category was any member of the public substantially and adversely affected by the violation. And the question the court had to sort out was whether that by the violation phrase meant a violation of the chapter or regulations or a violation of a certificate of need, which was the second category of persons who could challenge the statute. And the court determined that the lead-in language controlled, so the reference to violation was a violation of chapter or regulation, not a violation of a certificate of need.
Representative Gruenberg has a question for you.
This is just a comment. The statute is set out in the opinion on page 4, right under sub B.
We also have it at the end of the packet. Actually,
yeah.
We have it in the packet.
Oh, we do. Okay.
Last page.
Sorry.
We have it twice.
Sorry. Please don't let me interrupt you again, Gene. Go ahead.
Gina, let me ask you a question on page 13. Sometimes it's difficult for people reading this to see what was just said. For these reasons, we reverse the grants of summary judgment in favor of Advanced Pain and the state. Okay, does that mean the summary judgment was in favor of Advanced Pain and now it's reversed, or something opposite to that?
I'm sorry, you're referring to page 8 of the...
Page 13. It just comes... Subtitle 4, conclusion.
It's the last paragraph of the opinion, Gene.
Okay, all right. I just have a different version. So, yes, the court, rather than deciding that or finding that the Superior Court correctly decided this case on summary judgment motions, remanded the decision back to the trial court to determine whether or not the pain center, the one who essentially got away without a certificate of need, who won in the trial court on summary judgment, whether or not that determination by the commissioner was correct as a factual matter because the summary judgment was overturned in favor of the pain center.
So the pain center is the prevailing party?
No. We don't really know who the pain center, which party prevailed, but what the court decided was that Matthew Valley Medical Center had standing to bring the case to a full trial rather than be decided on summary judgment, that they lacked standing to challenge the failure to issue the certificate.
Is that their intent at this point, or do you know?
I actually don't know what occurred at the trial court on remand. I could look that up for you. They may have issued a settlement award. They may have entered into settlement negotiations. The commissioner ultimately determined that she believed the court had correctly interpreted the standing question in favor of Matthew Valley. So my guess is that the commissioner went back administratively and looked at the dollar amounts involved before it went to, if it went to trial at all.
Representative Holmes?
So, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Gene, what you're saying is that the commissioner actually agreed with what the Supreme Court, how it interpreted the grammatical wording of the statute?
Yes, although that was the former commissioner.
Okay, former commissioner. Well, that's helpful. I mean, it seems, Mr. Chairman, to me like this makes sense. I mean, it seemed to me like the court reached the right answer. I could see how it's confusing that we're using the word violation to to mean two different things in this same paragraph, whether you're violating the whole chapter of law or whether you're violating a certificate of need. And the first one clearly refers to violations of the statute. The second use clearly refers to violations of a certificate of need. And the third one just says violation with no clarification at all as to whether it's talking about violating the statute or violating the actual certificate of need. If you violated the, you could, and in this case, it seems like the question was, was there a violation of the statute because they didn't give a certificate of need, and was that a violation of the statute? Clearly, that's not a violation of certificate of need because no certificate was issued. So the question is, does that third word violation mean a violation of the chapter? It seems like that is the court parsed it out correctly. The question is, do we want to, if we agree with that, do we want to go back and add the words of this chapter in there at some point, clarify it, or do we just let court ruling stand and say they got it right, good enough?
Representative Gruenberg.
Mr. Chair, just to answer what I think was the gist of your question, looking at the final paragraph of the whole opinion, the trial court apparently had tossed out the case, dismissed it. The Supreme Court reversed that ruling and remanded the case, sent it back, with an order that the trial shall go forward. That's what that reversed and remanded. The question of statutory interpretation, again, it seems to me this is an area that's within the Committee of Health and Social Services rather than ours, and I would suggest that we refer this matter to them because...
To our colleague up here.
Yeah. assuming he's willing to accept that. But I don't feel very confident in making the decision on this one.
Well, you're right. The thing that strikes me is an MRI facility, we're talking, that stuff is $1 million a throw, and they probably spend more than $1 million. And yet, no, because that is in direct competition with the existing hospital's MRI facility. They could both go broke if they're trying to share a given clientele. And giving, allowing a new facility to simply, with no certificate of need, build an MRI facility, I think goes against the whole idea of why certificate of needs were created. So that's the issue for me.
Mr. Chairman,
I have a. Go ahead,
Jean.
Sorry, this is Jean Michelle again. That particular issue wasn't decided in this case.
Yeah.
There is a statutory threshold for purchases and leases associated with pain centers, but the question in this case that we recommended review on was whether a hospital had standing to challenge the underlying decision not on certificate of need. So it was a fairly technical question. It didn't get into the basis of certificate of needs at all otherwise.
Representative Lynn?
Thank you very much. The whole thing's rather confusing. Your language can be. Can anybody explain to me if a certificate of need is actually a more politically correct way of saying certificate of monopoly?
Yes. I feel the same way, Mr. Chairman. I have a real hard time sometimes with certificate of need. I've seen it used improperly. I've seen undue profits being made, and some doctors get together and say, this is ridiculous, our patients can't afford to have this done, we want to open up this, and the other side uses that certificate of need to stop that from happening and getting reasonable prices to the public. I have a problem sometimes with certificate of need.
As a matter of disclosure, I did have a bill to eliminate certificate of need.
I remember that. Now, we have monopolies that are perfectly legal, and your power company is a monopoly, because we don't think it makes sense for a second company to string power poles alongside the existing poles.
Right.
Once you have a monopoly, you're regulated, and I think under certificate of need, stop me if I'm wrong, there are regulations that go with it, not just an ability to control the market.
Of course, Mr. Chair, the case before today really doesn't get into the matter whether the CON is a good thing or a bad thing or somewhere in between. We're talking about the statute as it's actually written.
Representative Gruenberg?
Okay. Representative Keller was thinking that it shouldn't be referred to the other committee?
Representative Lynn, through the chair. The certificate of need is an incredibly volatile subject. We're talking about billions of dollars of, millions anyway, of dollars of public money. We have the throttle with the CON, as you can see, three. The decision whether or not a CON is needed or not is just extremely volatile decision. And the question that has been brought up to us here by Gene is not one of whether or not the CON should exist. It has to do with a fix of the language of what a violation is. And I have a clarification question for Gene on this. You said there were three entities that could deny the certificate of need, I think. In the case, it talks about this, the commissioner, and I forget the second one, and the third one is the a member of public at large, and a member of the public has to show some kind of a, if I read it right, some kind of a financial harm done before this is brought up. And is that not the number three, as a member of the public, is that not where Matt Valley brought this case in the first place? Am I right or wrong? Is it fuzzy? Help me out here.
This is Jean again. You're correct, Representative Keller.
It just that throws some interesting nuances of it, because there was nothing in the case, as I understood it, that showed any kind of financial harm to Matt Valley, Mattoon Clinic. So, in order the decision to take this up again and to press on, it just seems like it would, there's a conflict there, I think. I mean, I'm not sure, but they would have to show how we're talking about monopolies and the money that's available. They would have to show where the opening of the advanced pain clinic, financially harmed the other healthcare service providers in the area. It'd be very intense. I'd be surprised. A little surprised if my, and I understand, very limited understanding of this, I'd be very surprised if this case was appealed. Did you find that? I'm very interested in when it was remanded, what happened to it?
Okay, excuse me, this is Jean again. I'll be happy to do that, but I did want to correct you in that the court specifically looked at whether Matsu was substantially and adversely affected and found that it was a close question, but that it survived summary judgment. And they had to go back to the trial level to determine whether or not the challenge was factually valid. So the last section of the court's opinion, the court goes into some detail about why Matsu Valley had a financial stake in the decision.
I missed that. I read it too quick. Thank you. So long as
the Matsu Regional Medical Center offers the service, and then an identical service is offered about a tenth of a mile away, wouldn't that automatically adverse their profitability?
Representative Gatto, this is Jean again. The court wasn't satisfied with that. They looked at numbers of cases that were handled by Matsu Valley that were the same types of cases that the pain center would have been dealing with.
And the question I had, was the pain center an entirely new industry that regional medical did not offer?
No, the court's opinion found that there were 127 pain-related procedures that Matsu Valley had done the prior year that the pain center would be equally qualified to to do after this conversion.
Okay, Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to go back to the, I think it's a core issue. This, I guess I should start by saying, when I served in the legislature in the 1980s, we would have a session every year where the House Judiciary Committee would go over the cases in this report. Not everyone. And we would go over them very quickly, like we do on the Committee on Suggested State Legislation. And we would look at just the ones that, that were worthy of legislative review. And I don't recall dealing with technical kinds of... It's been 20 years since I did this. We haven't done it for a long time. This is the first meeting in 10 years of this committee dealing with this report. And so what we're doing today is setting the precedent, I hope, the way the House Judiciary Committee and maybe the Senate Judiciary Committee, too, will look at these reports. And I think, and Representative Lynn and I are on this committee on suggested state legislation from CSG, and there are about 1,000 laws, new laws that they look at every year to determine whether to put maybe 30 or 40 in a book, and we have to go through very quickly. What we customarily do, and you correct me if I'm wrong, Representative Lynn, is in many cases the laws are referred from another committee, which is like a referral here, but sometimes we refer them back to the committee when they deal with issues that are not within our expertise. And what I'm looking at here is very important from a precedent point of view. This is probably a discussion that needs to take place on these committees of need, but I think that we are the Judiciary Committee, and we should jealously guard our jurisdiction, and we should respectfully defer to the Committee of Primary Jurisdiction here. And this is a discussion that I think should take place in the Health Committee because it deals with that subject.
What typically happens is the Committee of Jurisdiction often says, well, that sounds like a legal issue. Judiciary will handle it.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I've been on committees, that's what's happened.
If I could respond.
Keller.
Yes. I wholeheartedly appreciate where you're coming from. However, in this case, the court, rightly or wrongly, and I determined legislative intent on the issue of how the word violations was used. And I, my quick reading of it says that that's probably true. You know, whether I agree with the legislative intent decision or not, the way the grammar lies and everything like that, the court came to a conclusion. To use that as justification to go back in and try to fix it and see that. Well, I'm certainly willing to bring it up to the Health and Services Committee. I didn't mean to imply that. Using this as justification is weak. I think the whole issue of certificate of need and needs to be reviewed. I think we need to look at Representative Lynn's bill. I think it's a very huge issue because what happens, they end up in court. A lot of times it's a financial maneuvering just to cost the provider that's trying to move in a whole bunch of money so they can't produce. You know, they can't go in and set themselves up. It's a big issue. It's a big problem in the state of Alaska. We're one of the few that have a certificate of need. I just don't think that this particular question, as addressed by the court, is justification for opening up the whole thing.
I'm not suggesting that. If we took this and we put in a judiciary bill or took, then that would end run your committee. That's my concern. And I would just say that we should ask your committee and you as the chair to decide what, if anything, to do, and then the thing.
Okay,
thing.
I wouldn't be opposed to that. I want to get into the next case, which...
So I'll move that the case and the note be referred to the HESC.
Is there an objection? Seeing and hearing none. So ordered. Abortions on minors... under the LexisNexis page 1, I noticed the name of one of our colleagues is in there. So it took me by surprise, but there it is. So the question we have before us is initiatives, right, and Parental Consent Act, Planned Parenthood, abortion for minors, who's responsible. This is such a complicated issue because the opposing parties on this issue are have their feet in concrete, and it's very difficult to get much movement. So is there someone from Legal Services that has addressed this question that can make some comments for us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This is Jean Michelle again with Legal Services.
Lucky you.
Well, this case does not substantively involve the issue of abortion. It's primarily a legislative initiative issue, and that is not my area of expertise, but I think I can analyze it adequately for you, and if you have further questions, we have more expertise within our office that can deal with that. But essentially what the court found in this case was that the initiative petition for the parental notification law that as you all know, was successful on the ballot, whether the petition summary that was circulated for signature purposes before the petition was placed on the ballot was accurate enough to go forward with the vote on the petition. And for the first time, the court determined that, or distinguished between a petition summary and a ballot summary, and determined that while both are held to a high level of accuracy, it was okay that the petition summary was deficient as a matter of law, because it could have been, and it was corrected on the ballot summary. And the three areas that the court had identified as being deficient in the ballot summary involved the failure of, and this is a ballot summary prepared by the Lieutenant Governor's office, not by the proponents of the petition, a fact that the court found fairly persuasive in determining that there was no intentional intent to mislead the signatories to the petition, but the Lieutenant Governor's summary left out a few key details in what the petition would actually do, one of which involved a failure or an omission of the felony, significant felony penalties that a physician would be subjected to if the physician violated, if the petition passed and a physician violated the notice procedures. And that was the primary concern of both the trial and the Supreme Court, that was left off the summary when people signed on. The other two issues involved the fact that the Parental Consent Act was being revived without clarifying to the voters that that's what was happening and that parts of that act had been previously invalidated as being unconstitutional. And the third omission was the fact that the Lieutenant Governor left out of the summary that that there were, it would restrict current law. The current law did not require parental consent or notice, and this changed that. In other words, there was already an opportunity for an abortion to be performed on a minor without either consent or notice. So those three issues, the Supreme Court agreed with the trial court, created a deficiency in the ballot, the petition summary, but the Supreme Court corrected the summary for purposes of the ballot, and when that initiative went to the vote, statewide vote, there was language in the summary and it attached to the initiative that included not only the felony provisions but the existing law that would be revised by the petition. So it became fairly cumbersome, but the court went through its own case law in this area and distinguished this deficiency from other similar, or maybe not similar, but other deficiencies they found in summaries, and determined that this wasn't so deficient that they couldn't correct it, but it was a fairly discretionary and fact-based decision on the part of the Supreme Court. And the I wanted to emphasize that the court recognized the importance of holding these petition summaries to a high level of accuracy and impartiality, but found that there were differences in the functions of those two summaries, so essentially kind of bent over backwards with this, or to allow the petition to go to voting people without having to go back and get new signatures. And the court looked at whether the summary omissions substantially misrepresented the essential nature of the initiative and found that it did not, even though the felony provisions were lacking. And also that the petition proponents had dedicated a significant amount of time and resources to gather the required signatures, so the hardship was great, and they discerned little hardship to the initiative opponents by allowing it to be corrected on the ballot. But that, as you all know, that particular initiative is still under consideration on a different issue at the Superior Court level in Anchorage. There was just on the 8th of this month a hearing on the constitutional questions involved in the petition itself. But this Supreme Court decision is significant in the voter right and procedures area and has very little to do with the constitutional questions about abortion rights.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
I looked at this, and it seemed like a reasonable opinion to me, but in accord with what our recent last two cases, the way we've handled them, is we've referred them to the Committee of Primary Jurisdiction, and election law is squarely within the jurisdiction of the state affairs, first instance, and then it comes here in the second instance. And the chair and the vice chair of that committee are also on this committee. So three of us are on it, and I'd respectfully suggest that we refer this to state affairs.
I object for purposes of discussion.
Representative Keller?
I don't see the point. This is an issue of voters' rights. The Supreme Court decided in the, you know, mode of saying, hey, the people have a right to vote on this issue, very clear, okay, and to bring this back to the state affairs, other than just for maybe consideration, you know, a good place for it to die or end up, that's fine, but to use this as a handle to get to a voter's rights question is weak. To use this as a handle to waste a lot of time in session talking about starting over on this whole thing on the parental consent issue when it's still pending is inappropriate. I think that I really appreciate Gene's your appraisal, your briefing, and I'm just very grateful for the information and insight I've gained into this case. But I just don't see the value that much in going back to the state affairs.
I have not made a motion.
Right. Note of that. Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just to start out, I don't see this discussion being anything about abortion or about this particular initiative. And so, yeah, no, and I completely agree with that analysis. this is a question about whether, you know, if there are deficiencies in the summary, what do we do? Do you throw it out or not? And I also don't think Representative Gruendorg was necessarily requesting that we send it to State Affairs for a bill or action. It was simply saying we don't want to overstep our jurisdiction in making the decision at the judiciary level. So, you know, I think it raises an interesting question of what do you do. There is, especially we've made a lot of changes to initiative law in recent years that have made it a lot harder to put initiatives on the ballot, and I'm very sympathetic to the idea that people put a lot of time and effort, and it's the lieutenant governor, not the initiative sponsors, who are drafting these things. And, you know, to go back to the initiative sponsors and say, sorry, the lieutenant governor didn't include everything in there, you got to go back and do all this legwork and cost again, that's a pretty serious burden. So I definitely see where the court came down. On the other hand, you know, we want the most accurate information. And so I guess what I think was, of the three issues that the court found with the petition, which Jean very nicely laid out for us, I agree with the court that the most concerning oversight was the fact that there was no mention of any criminal sanctions in it. And I think the court very clearly says, both in the majority opinion and in the dissent, that really we need that going forward. And I think we may not need legislation to do it. We may or may not. I would leave that up to the State Affairs Department committee. But I think that, at least as a legislature, we should think about, the question of whether or not in any initiative going forward, whether it deals with environmental policy, whether it deals with choice issues, whether it deals with, you know, regardless of what it deals with, or a whole bunch of it, whether it deals with, money or finances, if there are some sort of criminal penalties involved or criminal enforcement of any sort, whether it's a cruise ship initiative, whether it's whatever it is, if there's any sort of criminal penalties, if that's the sort of thing, should sanctions have to be in the summary? And that's sort of the question, the kinds of questions I would see that I would defer to the State Affairs Committee to just ruminate on. It may or may not need legislation, may or may not be interesting for discussion. But I would see that as being my prime issue that I take out of this case.
Ms. Bloomberg?
My comments have been more of a jurisdictional on committees, so that we don't appear to be overstepping our bounds here. We have the chair and the vice chair of State Affairs, and what the vice chair has said is that this is a good opinion and we can just leave it alone. I don't want, if we don't take any action and leave the opinion stand, I don't want the chair of the committee to feel that we're slighting State Affairs. I'm perfectly comfortable doing what you're saying, but I don't want you to feel that we're slighting the other thing.
I don't feel slighted whatsoever. And we're going to have a lot of bills in the next session, very important bills. Last session, I guess the 27th legislature, and we're just going to discuss this without the thought of entertaining some kind of legislation. I don't know what the point is.
And I think we can pass on
this. Yeah.
Don't say pass on an old man here.
we'll just pass away.
Don't say that either.
The chair can bring up anything he wants to on his own without requiring.
And there is litigation, not on this particular point, but there is litigation in process. Mm-hmm. As we speak, no one knows what they're going to do.
Okay, so we done with this one? Woohoo! Document fees.
Oh, we're going after
next one.
After the car sales.
I have a report on this.
A report on doc fees?
Yeah, I talked with Ed Sniffen.
Okay.
About this.
And you're Representative Gruendorg, so we get...
Yeah, I'm Max. the Attorney General has... He's not here, and I don't know what's going... I can't say anything, whether or not anything's going on. All I can say is there are discussions on this within the AG. There are very important
statute of limitations issues here. My suggestion is that we allow some time to pass and to see if anything is forthcoming from the administration before we take this up, and we just sort of at this point table this opinion, and the staff can be in touch with the AG, et cetera, and see if there's ever going to be anything forthcoming, because I just think it should be tabled until we find out from at least the administration what, if anything, they're going to recommend.
Well, my interpretation was that Attorney General says it's too difficult to make a decision because it can go either way. It's up to the legislature to define whether or not dock fees are legal.
No, that was the legislative review was by the Legislative Affairs Agency, not the Attorney General. The Attorney General was not a party to this litigation, and they are in the process of looking at the case. And I would simply suggest that maybe Sarah can check with them in a while and see if anything's forthcoming, because the issue really is when the statute of limitations begins to run in this particular statute, whether it's when the car was sold and the person saw that the $200 was charged, or when that person became aware that that was an illegal practice. And that has tremendous ramifications in all these unfair trade practices stuff, and I think we should just wait.
What about misrepresenting, where a customer challenged the dock fee and they said, there's nothing we can do? If and this happened to me, where I looked him square in the eye and I said, take the dock fee off. He says, I can't. And I said, well, yeah, you can. You just cross it out and then recalculate. And he said, and they put it on the contract in bold print, much bolder than the rest of the contract. And it's right next to taxes, insurance, and dock fees. Sounds like government fees. And was so that, I think it was very misleading.
This is only a statute of limitations.
Right. Got it. 2 years.
Yeah. And the question is when that begins to run. And
what's your thought on that? When you purchase the car, or when you first discover? I mean, in other law, is it you should have known?
Well, I asked Ed that question 10 minutes ago before we started. We've had two conversations today. And at first, as a result, I don't want to say anything that would have said. But as a result of that conversation, I came away with the impression that this statute was different than other statutes, and other statutes were sort of like when you became aware it was illegal. And then as a result of the second conversation, I became more confused, and I think he's going to do some research on it, which is your question. I asked him your question, and hopefully he's going to find out some more research on it.
Well, my feeling, of course, I'll repeat it, was that when you put it, say, taxes, license, and dock fees mingled in with state fees, and most people are paying $20,000, $30,000, the $200 fee doesn't even pay for an upgrade in the speaker system. They go, oh, who cares? But we should care. That was determined by talking to dealers that dock fees are simply extra profit, not anything else.
Oh, yeah, we've dealt with this. I think maybe you were on the State Affairs Committee when we dealt with this in the 15th
legislature.
Yeah. But I would just like to get some thoughts from the AG. So maybe we could table this in the beginning of this session or something.
Well, I don't know that it's just open in front of us to discuss here.
If Sarah could follow up.
Representative Lynn?
Well, the the issue as I see it is, you know, this is not whether dock fees are right or wrong. You know, they're not required. It's pure profit. We know that. But when does the statute of limitations start? And if it starts, if it's illegal and the consumer doesn't know that, ignorance of the law is no excuse. Isn't that correct? You have to, that's a date certain. But when I discover something, that's not a date certain. It could be today, tomorrow, or next week. And that opens up a whole bucket of worms there. Who knows what I might find if I go through all my records, if I just look around long enough and find something that I didn't know about.
That's the stuff you really get into. If you're going to say it doesn't begin to run until the consumer, Joe Sixpack, knows that this is illegal, that could be 20 years, if ever. This is not that simple.
And the issue, as I understand it, is not dock fees, yay or nay.
That's legal services. Does anyone want to weigh in on this highly important issue?
This is Jean Michelle again. Thank you. I agree with Representative Lynn's summary, and it is somewhat different from other statutes of limitations that we have, but we have a lot of them, and some are worded otherwise. But this unfair trade practices statute of limitations differs from our common law understanding of the discovery rule, as Representative Grunberg pointed out.
So I didn't get any part of that made an important contribution for me. 2-year statute of limitations on this one issue. Statute of limitations vary depending on other issues. Some of them could be longer. What about you were given medicine that caused you some harm, and you didn't discover the harm for 10 years? Now, was there a statute of limitations that said, hey, you got the wrong medicine, it's too late to object to it? But you say, well, this is the first time I noticed any change, and now my liver, I need a transplant.
That would be covered, because I think, if I may interrupt.
Go ahead.
If you look at the summary, it says that the 2-year limitations period begins to run when the plaintiff discovered or reasonably should have discovered that the conduct caused the loss. And what you're talking about, Mr. Chair, is you have a liver problem, and on a certain date you discover, and you're not unreasonably delaying, but you only reasonably knew from that date forward that the drug caused the loss. Then it begins to run from that date.
When you first discover it.
That's the current state of the law.
Representative Gatto, this is Jean Michelle again. I agree with that statement, and just to add to it, the court wasn't looking at so much when the harm, or the discovery question is when the harm actually occurred, and the discovery that something was illegal was not the point at which the court was willing to start the statute of limitations, and that the court looked very clearly at the date of harm, or in this case, the loss of the $200, but was unwilling to accept the proposition that because the plaintiff didn't know that it was illegal, that the plaintiff, that the statute of limitations was told, even though his loss occurred 2.5 years previously.
Yeah, the question has come up a few times in discussions within the legislature, kind of private discussions, that said, if you don't want to pay a dock fee, don't buy the car. And I said, but a person invested maybe weeks at a time searching for the right car to buy. There's only one dealer in Anchorage. The next dealer is up in Fairbanks, where you have sales tax. You're asking an individual to say, you know, that's an illegal charge, but the only way I can get out of it is to A, buy the car and then sue you, Is that what we're saying is what we want to do? Go to small claims court against the dealer over an illegal dock fee, and because you know it's illegal, and you're not only within the 2 years, but within the first probably week. Is that what the court feels is the appropriate procedure?
This is Jean again. The court's not making that judgment. The statute provides for other options like complaints to the Attorney General. But the problem in this case is that the plaintiff waited beyond the two-year period.
Got it. Okay. I think we're all agreeing on that. I guess since we've had proposals in state affairs for eliminating things like dock fees, we got much more involved in it than just statute of limitations as to whether or not any company ought to be able to disguise a fee under something that looked like a tax. And that's what we were trying to resolve. And this idea of the statute of limitations just sort of trailed behind that idea. We never really acted on it. Didn't know if we had the support to pass legislation against it. So, any more questions from the committee on this one subject?
Will you follow up with that? Or you... Okay, that's great. That'll save me doing it.
Okay.
That's if you let me know.
And now we'll go on to one of the major issues in the state and still have time for probably Representative Gruenberg, who wanted to bring up another issue when we're talking fish and game here. We're talking serious, serious stuff. I was looking at some of the attorneys' names, and I actually knew who they were.
Ron West, a lawyer himself. he's now moved to Oregon.
There's someone from legal services that is most familiar with this issue, because we've got friends of animals, fish and game. We've got lots of friends of the earth. We've got all kinds of organizations in here.
Mr. Chairman, Jean Michelle again with Legal Services. I reviewed this case for the purposes of the oversight report. I'm not a fish and game attorney, but we're in the process of hiring a new one. My recommendation was that the legislature review the case to determine whether the court correctly applied the intensive management statute in this case, and the primary issue that the court initially decided was whether the sustained yield requirement in Article 8, Section 4 of our Constitution applied to predators. And the court said it does. And as I understand it, we're the only state in the country with the sustained yield constitutional provision. That was a significant holding. And what the statute does is essentially implement the constitutional sustained yield requirement. And in addition to the statute, the Board of Game had both administrative regulations and a predator control plan that were all under scrutiny in this case. And the court determined that the plans, the regulations, and the statute all correctly implemented the constitutional sustained yield principle as it applied to the control of wolves and bears in specific game management units. And the court analyzed the statute, the intensive management statute, AS 1605-255, in the same way that it analyzed the constitutional provision. So if the legislature is dissatisfied with the outcome or finds that it's contrary to legislative intent, then the appropriate fix would involve a constitutional amendment as well, I believe. But essentially the court just upheld both the predator control plans that allow for aerial wolf hunting and high numbers of bear yields in certain units to control, to allow for moose and I believe caribou populations to recover. And the regulations provided some of that same level of detail. The court decided both that the sustained yield principle applied to predator populations, but also that the Board of Game applied, implemented sustained yield principles, even though this was kind of an interesting aspect of the case, that the regulations that were adopted subsequent to a 2006 decision invalidating those regulations took out the sustained yield language with regard to predator control. But the court found as a factual matter that the Board of Game adhered to sustained yield principles without saying it and gave some examples of why the court believed that to be true. So that's it.
Did the question of the Endangered Species Act enter into any of the testimony in that if you have a threatened moose population because of too many bears, too many wolves, and the young all disappearing before they're even 1 year old, but that endangers the prey population, so could someone apply the Endangered Species Act to say we need to get rid of bears and wolves?
Mr. Chairman, that issue did not arise in this case. I'm not sure that moose are listed as endangered or threatened in the state, but
And does that policy, you know, we were looking at specific areas where the moose were destined to disappear because of the predator pressures. So they're not an endangered species as a whole, but it reminds me of what happened up in the Arctic with polar bears. The total number of polar bears was actually increasing, but specific populations of polar bears were not. So the Endangered Species Act allowed them to remove a portion of land the size of California as their normal range and protect it from all hunting, even though the total populations were increasing. Which brings me back to the moose. If you go to Yenlo Hills, and Yenlo Hills used to be able to see 100 moose on a 2-hour flying trip, and now you're seeing one. Ultimately, I think Yenlo Hills will have no moose, and then I'm thinking about the bears. So, I guess it's a personal thing, but doesn't it make sense that you want to protect the populations in specific areas as well as the total population?
Mr. Chairman, this is Jean again. The court agreed generally with that principle that the specific game units and the range of the animal were significant in determining whether there was a sustainable yield decision. But something that I need to emphasize that I didn't previously is that while the sustained yield principle is now being interpreted as a constitutional matter as applying to predator populations, the court, one of the primary reason the court found that the aerial killing of wolves and killing of bear populations in specified units was consistent with that principle is because the court also found that both the Constitution and the statutory framework for sustained yield allowed for preferences for prey populations and over predator populations. And part of that was the beneficial use language and that the Board of Game found that human consumption was the highest and best use of the population, the wildlife in general.
And now with the court's decision that hunting took preference over, I'm not sure what it's called, viewing, where they say, I like to go in the woods and see predators, but hunting took a preference over that. Is that correct?
The hunting applies both to predator and prey populations, but the intensive management decisions and statutes provided for higher numbers of predators to be taken and in particular units than some biologists testified was sustainable, but the environmental value, of leaving the animals in their setting as a beneficial use, really didn't come up at the Supreme Court level. That may have been part of the evidence at the trial court, but the Supreme Court didn't focus on that. Comparison of human consumption versus wildlife viewing.
Curiously, did they refer to hunters as predators?
No.
Representative, just a question, Gene. Maybe I gripped it here a little bit, but what? Why did you bring this case up for legislative review? I mean, that I'm really curious. I mean, the court made a decision here, and I don't see why you brought it back to us.
Representative Keller, the four reasons we've summarized cases for this oversight report for legislative consideration include whether the courts have modified or revised the common law of the state, and that happened in this case.
Thank you.
Very
light.
So, I like the conclusion, page 16. We affirm the Superior Court's ruling regarding the applicability of Alaska's sustained yield clause to predator populations. But then they went on and reversed a ruling that does not apply to predator populations. Guess we get both sides. Okay, Representative Gruenberg, you were kind of done with the five cases that I selected, and you wanted to...
Well, did we want to refer this to resources or do anything with it?
This one?
Yeah.
I think it's been decided.
All right, okay. Then I'm not going to make a motion. Yeah, there were just a couple of things. And I know Ms. Carpinetti is on the phone, and that she will talk about one of the cases I was going to mention. I wonder, but I think she was going to maybe talk about something else. I was wondering, Mr. Chair, could we ask her to
go ahead?
Annie Carpinetti, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Why then? Okay. Mr. Chair, can we invite her to testify,
please?
Thank you very much for giving the Department of Law some time to describe a couple of cases that we thought might be of interest to the Judiciary Committee at this time. And I'm going to make them my descriptions really short and sweet. And if you have questions, I will do my best to answer them. The first case involves a challenge to the bail revision law that was enacted in 2010 that this committee worked really hard on. It was a lawsuit filed the day before the effective date of the legislation by a group of defense attorneys, the Alaska Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, three named defense lawyers versus the state of Alaska and Dan Sullivan in his capacity as Attorney General. The complaint was for both declaratory and injunctive relief. They sought a temporary restraining order to stop the enforcement of several provisions of the bail revision law. There were 10 claims, the 10 areas of the bail revision law that they claimed were defective. I'm just going to describe a few of the highlights. The first was claiming that the presumption of dangerousness and flight risk for certain defendants that are generally charged with very serious offenses had the effect of denying the right to bail that is guaranteed by the Constitution. Another claim that was made in the lawsuit was that the required $250,000 bail for second offense methamphetamine manufacture charges violated the person's right to bail. And then another one was, another claim that they made was that the cooling off period in domestic violence cases, which prohibited a judge from allowing a person charged with a crime involving domestic violence from returning to the home of the victim for 20 days, violated the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. Our response to both aspects of the case and for the temporary restraining order was that the plaintiffs had not established irreparable harm because the plaintiffs, who I will call the lawyers in this case, just for ease, the lawyers weren't representing any particular defendants. They were bringing this action on their own without a person who had been denied bail or had a personal interest in the outcome of the case. And our the state's defense was that that the plaintiffs did not have standing to bring the lawsuit. That the case wasn't right because it hadn't been applied to an individual, and the plaintiffs on their own as defense lawyers had not established harm to themselves. The Superior Court in denied the temporary restraining order in every instance except for one, and that's the one involving the 20-day cooling off period for domestic violence defendants. And just for a little background, I don't know how helpful this will be, but in 1996, when the state passed the Domestic Violence Prevention Act, one of the provisions of that law was that a court may not allow a person charged with a crime involving domestic violence to return to the home at all while the person was released on bail. That provision was challenged in a lawsuit that was decided in 2006, the Williams case, where the Court of Appeals decided that that provision violated the constitutional right to equal protection of the law. So when the state rewrote the bail statutes, when the legislature rewrote the bail statutes, they changed it to a 20-day cooling off period. The trial court in this particular case found that that provision was too similar to the one that was found invalid in the Williams case, and the court issued a temporary restraining order, not only for his court, but for every other trial court in the state from applying that provision of the law. But the trial court ruled in favor of the state in every other aspect in terms of the temporary restraining order. Both parties petitioned to the Alaska Supreme Court from the trial court's decision. The Supreme Court vacated the Superior Court decision as it applied to other trial or judicial officers in the state. The court, it was a one-page decision, but it vacated it in that respect. And I think the theory is that a trial court can decide for his or herself the law, but it can't make that decision, impose that decision on other trial court judges. So the court vacated the decision in that respect, and it denied the petitions in other respects, so it didn't reach any of the other issues. The case returned to the trial court for the issue of the declaratory relief, where the Superior Court granted the state's motion to dismiss based on lack of standing by the plaintiffs. So that's where we are right now. That the order was dated April 12, 2011. The lawyers made a motion for reconsideration, which was denied May 23rd of this year, and a final judgment was entered July 18th of this year, vacating the temporary restraining order and granting final judgment in favor of the state. At this point, the decision has not been appealed yet. It's past the 30-day deadline for appealing, although there's there's always a chance that under the court rules that the court could relax that for a period of 60 days. So that's that decision, and there really isn't any legislative action to suggest to you at this point, but if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try and answer them.
Senator Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Carpinetti, so the ultimate result was that the provision by the Superior Court, the injunction on the 20-day cooling off period, was subsequently vacated, in other words, set aside, because the plaintiffs didn't have standing. So,
well, no, it was vacated as it applied to other Superior Court judges and other judicial officers. And then later the entire case was dismissed for lack of standing by the defense lawyers.
So even that provision was denied?
Yes.
Okay. So the only order that would potentially be at least out there potentially for somebody to look at was a 20-day cooling off period?
At this point, yes. Yeah, and I should add in this regard that other superior courts have made decisions based on challenges to the bail revision law and have upheld the law so far. And you know, they may be appealed to the. I'm sure they will be appealed to the Court of Appeals. And but at this point, other superior court judges have decided in favor of upholding the bail revision challenges that have been made to them individually.
So it would probably be premature for this committee to do anything.
I think so, yes. But we thought since it was such a major legislative revision, you would like to know the status of the challenge.
Well, unless other people have any questions, you were going to talk about another case, too?
Yes.
Before you do, let me ask you this question.
Sure,
I'm
sure.
Going to go back to vehicles and dock fees.
Uh-oh.
When you purchase a car, I'm going to bet that the amount of paperwork is probably a quarter inch thick. And you can search through, it's like HIPAA agreements or something. So a person could easily not notice that there even is a dock fee. And not even know if it's legal or illegal. Should we at least deal with it in judiciary or maybe deal with legislation that says a person is not responsible to know something, but when he discovers it, that's when the statute of limitations begins, rather than he should have known or could have known, but under the circumstances, I mean, it's like reading a small book. All the print is minuscule, and is that something that, because I have a feeling one of the representatives wants to submit legislation eliminating dock fees, but maybe we could deal with it from the point of view of when does the statute of limitations really begin?
Chairman Gatto, I have to defer that question to my colleague Ed Smithson. I'm not familiar with that decision, and I'm not familiar with the issue at all, and I really feel like I would be overstepping my knowledge and my authority by commenting on that.
Can't have that, so send your colleague.
Sorry. I'm sorry to pass that off, but I really have to. The second lawsuit that I are there any other questions, or would you like me to go on to describe the second lawsuit I wanted to tell you about?
Thank you.
Okay. The second one I wanted to report to you about was the American Booksellers Foundation for Free Expression et al. Versus Daniel Sullivan in his official capacity as the Attorney General. And this involves changes in the statute prohibiting the distribution of indecent materials to minors, AS 1161-128. And the changes were made in Senate, were eventually adopted in Senate Bill 222, but a lot of the work was done in its companion bill, House Bill 298, in the House Judiciary Committee. And the committee did a lot of work on that statute and spent a good deal of time on it. And for that reason, I wanted to just describe where we are now. And before I describe the decision, I would like to just discuss a couple of ironies in the lawsuit itself. SB 222 actually narrowed the effect or the scope of the statute prohibiting the distribution of indecent materials to a minor. And maybe it would help just to describe what the elements of the offense are right now under the law that was adopted in SB 222. And that it prohibits a person over 18 years of age from distributing material that depicts certain prescribed conduct, for example, sexual penetration, to a person under 16 or a person that the defendant believes to be under 16 years of age, and the material must be harmful to minors. And the House Judiciary added that element that the state is required to prove beyond a reasonable doubt to 1161.128, which is why the work that was done in the legislature in your committee was actually narrowing the effect of the law. The standard for proving whether or not the material was harmful to minors is a three-part definition, which requires the state to prove that the average individual applying contemporary community standards would find the material taken as a whole appeals to the prurient interest in sex in persons under 16. Second, that a reasonable person would find that the material taken as a whole lacks serious artistic, literary, educational, political, or scientific value for persons under 16 years of age, and that the material depicts actual or simulated conduct in a way that is patently offensive to the prevailing standards in the adult community with respect to what is suitable for a person under 16. So that element was added in the House Judiciary Committee to what the state is required to prove in prosecuting a person under this statute. There were a couple of things that were disappointing in the process, and that one of them was that in the House Judiciary Committee, I recall a representative from the ACLU giving an opinion that he thought that with the additions made in the House Judiciary Committee that the statute would probably withstand constitutional muster. Another disappointment was this statute was litigated in federal court, and the state had asked the federal district judge to certify the question to the Alaska Supreme Court, a question asking them to interpret the statute according to Alaska law, and unfortunately the court declined to take that question. I'll try and just summarize the claims that were made by the booksellers and the various other plaintiffs.
And hold on a second. Representative Gruenberg wants to ask a question.
Ms. Clark,
sure.
Did the federal judge refuse to certify it, or did the Supreme Court refuse to accept the certification?
I'm sorry, I didn't make it clear. The federal judge certified the question, and the Alaska Supreme Court refused to take it.
Without opinion?
Yes.
That's kind of unusual, isn't it?
Well, not recently. I don't think it's that unusual.
I thought you might have nothing.
I don't have any inside knowledge. It was a four-person court, and I wouldn't anyway. So anyway, there was no rationale given. They just did not accept the question. Let's see. And anyway, the main claim of the lawsuit was that the statute is overbroad. And a statute is overbroad when it prohibits constitutionally protected conduct as well as conduct that can be legitimately regulated by the state. The claim was that the contemporary state community standards of the definition of harmful to minors was overbroad and vague, that there was no distinction between what might be harmful to an older minor, even though the minor was under 16, as compared to a younger minor, that it was not the least restrictive alternative to regulate this behavior, and that the culpable mental states were not necessarily clear, that it wasn't absolutely clear that the defendant must know the contents of the material that he or she is distributing, and it wasn't necessarily clear that the defendant knew or was reckless regarding the age of the recipient that he or she was distributing the material to. There was also a claim that the statute inhibits interstate commerce, which is kind of unusual, but that was a claim that was made. The state's response was that, first, that the statute, SB 222, actually narrows the focus of AS 1161-128, that the state has a compelling interest in the safety of its children, and that the statute was narrowly tailored and the least restrictive alternative under the circumstances, mainly because it only restricts certain specified images to be distributed, and our position was that the harmful to minors definition that was adopted by the legislature met the United States Supreme Court decisions of Miller and Ginsburg in upholding the definition of harmful to minors. We also argued that the claim that it didn't, the statute doesn't differentiate between an older group of minors as opposed to a younger group of minors was irrelevant because if it's not harmful to a certain group of minors, it would not be found harmful to minors. And in terms of the Commerce Clause, our argument was that our state has jurisdiction to protect its citizens, and even if conduct is completely, a defendant's conduct is completely carried out outside the state, we still have jurisdiction if a victim is within our state, and that's statutory law and decisional law, too. The court decided that the state obviously has a compelling interest in the safety of its children, and it also upheld the harmful to minors definition in SB 222, finding that the definition does meet the United States Supreme Court's decisions in Miller and Ginsburg. But it ultimately held that the statute was overbroad, that it did prohibit constitutionally protected conduct in addition to conduct that is not protected, and it invalidated the statute not only as it was changed in SB 222, but as it had been before the amendments to SB 222. So that's where we are in terms of that piece of litigation, that piece of litigation and statute, and we're looking at our alternatives, but we'll probably be asking you to consider an amendment to the statute because right now we are prohibited from enforcing it.
Ms. Carbonetti, did you mention that if it's illegal for a certain group of minors, it must be illegal for all groups of minors? Is there something, you know, when you're between the ages of 4 and 6 that we think is inappropriate, but are you not a minor when you pass, what, 17, 18?
Well, the statute prohibits distribution to persons under 16. And one of the concerns was that, you know, minors that are 13 and 14 may have different interests than minors that are 7 or 8. But our argument to the court was that if it's not harmful to any group of minors, it wouldn't be considered harmful to minors. The court did not, the court upheld the definition that the House Judiciary Committee, I believe, put into the statute requiring that the material, in order to be illegal, has to be harmful to minors.
Senator Gruenberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions, Ms. Carpinetti.
Yes,
first,
yes.
Is the state considering an appeal?
At this point, we are not considering an appeal of this decision. And we think that we would probably not have a very good chance of prevailing in the Court of Appeals.
Second question, and this gets back to the question I asked you a minute ago. I had not ever considered the court rule that allows a federal court to refer a question of law to the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have my civil rules or my appellate rules with me that basically, as I recall, gives the Supreme Court discretion whether to accept that referral. And I had not ever been involved in a case, since family law cases generally don't go to federal court. I had never been involved personally in a case where that issue came up. And I'm wondering whether at some point the legislature or possibly the court, the Appellate Rules Advisory Committee, I sat on that at one time, ought to take a look at whether there should be some standards, because if a federal judge considers it an important enough question to refer to the Supreme Court, should the court have complete discretion on that question? And I don't want to put you in an awkward position here personally or professionally. Any comment?
My only comment is I'm not very familiar with this area of the law either, but I would be happy to look at it and report to you later. But all I know at this point is that they did not accept the certified question and that that's not unusual. But I don't know how many, you know, I don't know what the track record is of accepting them versus not accepting them. I'm just not that familiar with this area of the law.
Yeah, I would welcome any thoughts you have. I see we have Quinlan Steiner here also, who's here observing, and I don't know whether the defense bar has any thoughts on this or anything else. He's probably come up more in civil cases. But anyway, would welcome any thoughts. I don't have any other questions on this. I don't know if anybody else does, but there's another case I wanted to ask her about that she's prepared to talk about.
We're a little over time, but I don't think it's very much unless we have airplane reservations or something.
Not till 5?
Not till 5?
No, 4.
Fly
out of 4.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Ms. Carpinetti, was the only case on your agenda then to talk about is the Bridge case?
The only one left, yes. Yeah, and I can just describe it really quickly. It involved a person who was charged and convicted of escape in the second degree in violation of AS 1156.310, which prohibits a person from removing him or herself from a correctional facility while under official detention. So the defendant, and the facts are kind of important in this case, the defendant had been charged with driving with a license suspended, which is a misdemeanor. He was unable to make the bail that was set by the court. And because the jail in Fairbanks was full, he was placed at the North Star Center, which apparently wears a couple of hats at times. One of them is a halfway house, and another is to house people under the circumstances that Mr. Bridge was in. He eventually walked away from the North Star Center and charged and convicted of escape in the second degree. His conviction was appealed to the Court of Appeals, which reversed his conviction for escape in the second degree, finding that the definition of correctional center in our law provides that it is a correctional facility or premises used for confinement of persons under official detention. And while official detention is defined in our statutes very broadly, the term confinement is not. And because the North Star Center, the people who were placed there were told that they couldn't leave, but there was no gate, there were no guards with weapons, nothing to hold them in. And in fact, the staff at North Star Center had been trained to not to only call the police if somebody walked away. That his position in North Star Center should not be considered confinement under our law, because in fact there were no guards, no guns, nothing to stop this person except being told that he was not allowed to leave. So his conviction was reversed, and that's where we are in terms of that decision. In response to that decision, the Department of Law has appointed a committee of prosecutors to look at it and make some recommendations, but we haven't come to any conclusions at this point of what we think ought to be done. Maybe you have some ideas, but we don't have any recommendations at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Representative Gruenberg for the record. When I saw the article in the paper here, I looked at it and took it to my number one constituent, and Kayla also thought it was something maybe this committee ought to look at. And the Daily News Miner, as I said, did an editorial on this, and I've read the opinion, and it was a 2-1 decision.
Mm-hmm.
It was correct. The Split Court of Appeals, and Ms. Carpinetti informed me earlier today that the state is not appealing that decision, right?
That's correct. Well, we don't have a right to appeal. We could petition for review in the Alaska Supreme Court, but we are not going to do that.
I meant petition for a hearing.
Right.
And what I thought we should do, recommend to the committee and maybe the Attorney General, is if we could ask the Attorney General to let us know what result of their review, what the state attorney general is going to do on the subject, we can kind of wait for their response before we decide what we're going to do. That'd be my recommendation.
Representative Holmes, do you agree with their recommendation?
Well, Chairman, I do.
It's 100% of the attorneys.
And that leaves me with only, if we may pass to my final item here.
Final question.
Okay, if the members have their book here, there's one case. It's on page 7, and it's called, the name of the case is called Hertz versus Carruthers. And I'm going to read it, if I may, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if this is appropriate to ask Ms. Carpinetti about or somebody else. The state was awarded attorney's fees after Hertz lost a lawsuit against the state. The state attempted to execute on Hertz's prisoner trust account and directed the Alaska State Troopers to serve the writ of execution on the superintendent at Spring Creek and notices of execution on Hertz, who was the prisoner. The trooper served the paperwork on the superintendent and did not serve Hertz with any paperwork. Sometime later, the state faxed copies of the paperwork to the institution, and a guard served the faxed paperwork on Hertz. Although Hertz eventually received actual notice of the execution, the Alaska Supreme Court found that Hertz had not been properly served as required by statute or court rule, and that execution could not proceed. And the case is Hertz versus Carruthers, 225 P3rd. 571 Alaska 2010. Legislative review is recommended to determine if the legislature should provide specific guidance and procedures for service of process on prisoners in state correctional facilities, or should include prison guards in the definition of peace officer for purposes of service of process under Rule 4, Alaska Rule of Civil Procedure, because peace officers can make service. And I'm just wondering, do we have anybody there, either from Ledge Legal or the state, who would like to comment? And I have a note here. Jerry Luckup may have a comment if he's still online. I was wondering, Mr. to the chair, if there's anybody out there who could or would comment.
Mr. Chairman, this is Jerry Luckup down in Juneau. I wrote this review, and it would appear it'd be something that the legislature should at least take a look at. Service process on prisoners is not the court rules dealing with service process don't envision service of process on a prisoner. The legislature may want to, as I described in my recommendation, may want to take care of this issue and deal with this so we don't have this reoccurring in the future.
Representative Gruenberg.
That would be my recommendation also. And I would suggest, would request, and I don't know if it's official motions necessary, but that we ask Mr. Lockup if he'd like to do any kind of a memorandum with potential suggestions, and we also send Commissioner Joe Schmidt
a similar letter, see what they suggest in the administration, that we get that, and then we the chair can, and if that could be sent by the chair and then distributed to the members of the committee, then we can sort of informally decide whether to put in a committee bill or something on this.
Representative Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What ramifications would a revised definition of peace officer have in cases and matters beyond this? Because, you know, peace officer, that's a pretty broad situation. Who is and who is not a peace officer beyond this particular case?
Well, I think it says prison guards in the definition of peace officer.
Well, are they now peace officers?
I guess not.
And so what I'm saying is, if we change the definition of peace officer, what ramification would that have throughout every piece of legislation that we have that involves peace officers?
Yeah. Representative Grunberg.
Mr. Chair, I don't think we would technically do it quite that way. We would simply say correctional officer or peace officer. We wouldn't we wouldn't change the definition. We would just make it clear that they could do it.
That makes sense.
One of the ramifications could be when negotiating contracts.
Yeah, but we're not. This is simply civil law.
That's what I was thinking when he brought that question up. If we put them in peace officers, then
it would probably be the simplest thing, possibly, and I don't know if Jerry or these other guys can look at it, but to simply make those few changes in Civil Rule 4, it would take a two-thirds vote, but I don't think people are going to object to changing
No, not
that.
When you explain what...
Mr. Chairman, this is Jerry Luckup again. What I was meaning there with dealing with that definition of peace officer would not generally be an amendment to the definition of peace officer, for example, that we have in Title 11 or Title 12, but it would be referring directly to, for service of process, the definition of peace officer for purposes of serving process on a prisoner. We could include correctional officers in that definition or separately refer to them when dealing with a prisoner of an institution. I had one slight little comment dealing with the last case that Annie Carpinetti brought up, the case on official detention. That will be in our oversight report for the coming year. I'm in the process of writing a review for that case now and recommending review by the legislature. The argument of the dissent in that case, again, as pointed out by Representative Grunberg, it was a 2-1 case, that the discussion by the dissent seems particularly apt to how the case should be should have been resolved. And I can make any changes the committee might like in that regards. We should be able to resolve it, I would assume, without too much trouble.
That's the bridge case.
Okay.
If you would like on this Hertz thing, I am happy to be a subcommittee of one or anything to follow through on that if you want a subcommittee of one.
Well, that's automatic. We're all a subcommittee of one.
If you want me to do that.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering, since we have the public defender who's been sitting very patiently in the back, I just wondered, he may or may not have anything to add, but I thought we should maybe extend the opportunity with your permission.
Mr. Steiner, did you want to come up and say you guys missed the big point?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Quinlan Steiner. I'm the director of the Alaska Public Defender Agency. In reference to the bridge case, I won't go so far as to say you missed the big picture, but I would like to talk to Mr. Luckup about it afterwards. There's a certain consistency to the opinion as it came out, not with respect to the basis for it, which is rather complicated. But in that case, he was originally convicted of a B felony for walking away from what was essentially a halfway house. Had that occurred in a courtroom where there was actually public safety officers available, it would have been a C felony. So there's actually inconsistency in the statute. And the way it was resolved by the court actually sort of takes care of that. He was ultimately convicted of a misdemeanor as a matter of law for having walked away from what is essentially an unsecure facility. So there was a certain consistency with the outcome, and that in any change to this scheme ought to be addressed or looked at, because really what happens is this Escape 2 is sort of encompassed misdemeanor-level conduct and advanced it all the way up to a B felony, and it's just a quirk in the way that it's written. But I think the consistency overall ought to be addressed if the committee is going to look at this case in particular.
We put a person in an unsecured facility that we don't want to walk away. Should we just give them an ankle bracelet?
That is a misdemeanor. It's a very technical set of circumstances that get you from misdemeanor to the B felony. But I think electronic monitoring, you know, when you're in house arrest and that type of thing, is in fact a misdemeanor. There's different ways that can aggravate these cases. One is, you know, your status as a felon, or being, in custody on a felony or in custody on a misdemeanor. Whether or not you're in a jail facility or like in this halfway house, or whether or not you've used a weapon to escape, these things will advance misdemeanors to felonies. And in this particular case, he was in for a misdemeanor, and most circumstances would say that escape would be a misdemeanor unless it was an actual jail or he used a weapon. So in this case, you know, the fact that he was in an unsecured facility would normally make it a misdemeanor under the sort of general scheme, because this quirk of how you define correctional facility, which actually uses confinement, it's a bit circular in its definition. It got advanced all the way to a B felony when, had he been in jail, transported to the court, and then walked away, it would have been a C felony. So it's kind of technical, but I hope that makes sense. That's why there's some consistency, even though technically, as a matter of the way he's defined, you could easily sort of draw the distinction.
Representative Gruenberg?
Maybe, since this is sort of getting confusing to me, we could ask Ledge Legal or somebody to do a memo on the escape statutes and the facts that are for each offense and the penalties, so we can see where this sort of thing should be and try to make certain that they are consistent with each other before we decide exactly how we want to do it.
What if we escape from Juno during session?
They send the troopers.
That misdemeanor?
That happened in the third.
What if we go to the next state?
I think that happened in Texas.
Yeah, I think
well, in Wisconsin Senate, that went over to Michigan.
Well, and Texas went to Oklahoma.
Do you want to have a research?
I think, did I want to have what?
A little research paper done stating the different types of escape.
Yeah, no objection to having that outlined for us.
Sure.
Who would do it?
Jerry.
Jerry, did you hear that? You've got an assignment from Representative Gruenberg.
Oh, boy. Well, it's on the record now.
Yeah, would you listing the various escape things and the penalties and the circumstances so we can see where this sort of thing would fit. And then I'd like your recommendation and Mr. Steiner's recommendation on how we should deal with this and any other inconsistency. As long as we're looking at it, we might as well look at it.
Well, we like looking at things. Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I know that when Annie Carbonetti was talking to us, she said that I think on this issue and maybe some others, she had groups of prosecutors looking at it, and I would just encourage her, as I'm sure she's planning to do already, to loop the public defender's office in on some of those discussions. I'm sure she's already planning to do it, but
And Ms. Carbonetti, did you hear Lynn, Representative Holmes' comments?
Yes, I did, and I will certainly do so.
Well, it's fun putting stuff on the record. With that, unless somebody has some really compelling statement to make, I'm going to adjourn the meeting. Any objections? We're adjourned.
Issue maybe, but anyway, if you're sure.